church, the parish one, round which is a big graveyard, all full of tombstones. This is, to my mind, the nicest spot in Whitby, for it lies right over the town and has a full view of the harbour and all up the bay to where the headland, called Kettleness, stretches out into the sea. It descends so steeply over the harbour that part of the bank has fallen away and some of the graves have been destroyed. In one place, part of the stonework of the graves stretches out over the sandy pathway far below. There are walks, with seats beside them, through the churchyard, and people go and sit there all day long, looking at the beautiful view and enjoying the breeze. I shall come and sit here often myself and work. Indeed, I am writing now, with my book on my knee, and listening to the talk of three old men who are sitting beside me. They seem to do nothing all day but sit here and talk. The harbour lies below me, with, on the far side, one long granite wall stretching out into the sea, with a curve outwards at the end of it, in the middle of which is a lighthouse. A heavy sea wall runs along outside of it. On the near side, the sea wall makes an elbow crooked inversely, and its end, too, has a lighthouse. Between the two piers there is a narrow opening into the harbour, which then suddenly widens. It is nice at high tide, but when the tide is out it shoals away to nothing, and there is merely the stream of the Esk running between banks of sand, with rocks here and there. Outside the harbour on this side there rises for about half a mile a great reef, the sharp of which runs straight out from behind the south lighthouse. At the end of it is a buoy with a bell, which swings in bad weather and sends in a mournful sound on the wind. They have a legend here that when a ship is lost, bells are heard out at sea. I must ask the old man about this. He is coming this way. He is a funny old man. He must be awfully old, for his face is gnarled and twisted like the bark of a tree. He tells me that he is nearly 100, and that he was a sailor in the Greenland fishing fleet when Waterloo was fought. He is, I am afraid, a very sceptical person, for when I asked him about the bells at sea and the white lady at the abbey, he said very brusquely, "I wouldn't fash mysel about them, miss. Them things be all wore out. Mind, I don't say that there never was, but I do say that there wasn't in my time. They be all very well for comers and trippers and the like, but not for a nice young lady like you. Them feet folks from York and Leeds that be always eatin' cured herrings and drinkin' tea and lookin' out to buy cheap jet would creed aught. I wonder myself who'd be bothered tellin' lies to them, even the newspapers, which is full of fool talk."
I thought he would be a good person to learn interesting things from, so I asked him if he would mind telling me something about the whale fishing in the old days. He was just settling himself to begin when the clock struck six, whereupon he laboured to get up and said,
"I must gang againwards home now, miss. My granddaughter doesn't like to be kept waiting when the tea is ready, for it takes me time to crammel aboon the grease, for there be many of them, and, miss, I lack belly timber sairly by the clock."
He hobbled away, and I could see him hurrying, as well as he could, down the steps. The steps are a great feature of the place. They lead from the town to the church. There are hundreds of them, I do not know how many, and they wind up in a delicate curve. The slope is so gentle that a horse could easily walk up and down them. I think they must originally have had something to do with the abbey. I shall go home too. Lucy went out visiting with her mother, and as they were only duty calls, I did not go. They will be home by this. 25 July. I came up here an hour ago with Lucy, and we had a most interesting talk with my old friend and the two others who always come and join him. He is evidently the Sir Oracle of them, and I should think must have been in his time a most dictatorial person. He will not admit anything and down-faces everybody. If he can't out-argue them, he bullies them and then takes their silence for agreement with his views. Lucy was looking sweetly pretty in her white lawn frock. She has got a beautiful colour since she has been here. I noticed that the old men did not lose any time in coming and sitting near her when we sat down. She is so sweet with old people. I think they all fell in love with her on the spot. Even my old man succumbed and did not contradict her, but gave me double share instead. I got him on the subject of the legends, and he went off at once into a sort of sermon. I must try to remember it and put it down.
It be all fool talk, lock, stock and barrel, that's what it be, and nowt else. These bairns and wafts and boar ghosts and bar guests and bogles and all anent them is only fit to set bairns and dizzy women a-belderin'. They be nowt but air blebs. They and all grims and signs and warnings be all invented by parsons and ilsome burt buddies and railway touters to scare and scun a halflings and to get folks to do something that they don't other incline to. It makes me awful to think of them. Why, it's them that, not content with printing lies on paper and preaching them out of pulpits, does want to be cutting them on the tombstones. Look here, all around you, and whate'er you will, all them stains holding up their heads as well as they can out of their pride is a cant simply tumbling down with the weight of the lies wrote on them. Here lies the body, or sacred to the memory, wrote on all of them, and yet in nigh half of them there beat no bodies at all, and the memories of them being cared a pinch of snuff about, much less sacred. Lies, all of them. Nothing but lies of one kind or another. My gog, but it'll be a quare scowdement at the day of judgment when they come tumbling up in their death sarks all duped together and trying to drag their tombstones with them to prove how good they was, some of them trembling and dithering, with their hands that dozened and slippery from lying in the sea that they can't even keep their grip of them.
I could see from the old fellow's self-satisfied air and the way in which he looked round for the approval of his cronies that he was showing off, so I put in a word to keep him going. "Oh, Mr. Swales, you can't be serious. Surely these tombstones are not all wrong."
"Yablins, there may be a poorish few not wrong, savin' where they make out the people too good, for there be folk that do think a barn ball be like the sea, if only it be their own. The whole thing be only lies. Now look you here, you come here a stranger, and you see this Kirkgarth?"
I nodded, for I thought it better to assent, though I did not quite understand his dialect. I knew it had something to do with the church. He went on,
"And you can't say that all these stains be a bon folk that be happed here, snood and snug?"
I assented again.
"Then that be just where the lie comes in. Why, there be scores of these laybeds that be tombers old Dun's backerbox on Friday night."
He nudged one of his companions, and they all laughed.
"And my gog, how could they be otherwise? Look at that one, the aftest abaft the beer bank. Read it."
I went over and read, "Edward Spenceley, Master Mariner, murdered by pirates off the coast of Andros, April 1854, age 30. When I came back, Mr. Swales went on,
"Who brought him home, I wonder, to happy mere, murdered off the coast of Andros, and you can't say it, his body lay under? Why, I could name you a dozen whose bones lie in the Greenland seas above," he pointed northwards, "or where the currents may have drifted them. There be the stains around you. You can, with your young eyes, read the small print of the lies from here. This Braithwaite Lowry, I knew his father, lost in the Lively off Greenland in 20, or Andrew Woodhouse, drowned in the same seas in 1777, or John Paxton, drowned off Cape Farewell a year later, or old John Rawlins, whose grandfather sailed with me, drowned in the Gulf of Finland in 50. Do you think that all these men will have to make a rush to Whitby when the trumpet sounds? I have me anthurums about it. I tell you that when they got here, they'd be jumbling and jostling one another that way, that it'd be like a fight up on the ice in the old days, when we'd be at one another from daylight to dark, and trying to tie up our cuts by the Aurora Borealis."
This was evidently local pleasantry, for the old man cackled over it, and his cronies joined in with gusto. "But," I said, "surely you are not quite correct, for you start on the assumption that all the poor people, or their spirits, will have to take their tombstones with them on the Day of Judgment. Do you think that will be really necessary?"
"Why, what else be their tombstones for? Answer me that, miss."
"To please their relatives, I suppose."
"To please their relatives, you suppose?"
This he said with intense scorn.
"How will it pleasure their relatives to know that lies is wrote over them, and that everybody in the place knows that they be lies?"
He pointed to a stone at our feet, which had been laid down as a slab on which the seat was rested, close to the edge of the cliff.
"Read the lies on that thruff stone," he said.
The letters were upside down to me from where I sat, but Lucy was more opposite to them, so she leant over and read,
sacred to the memory of George Cannon, who died in the hopes of a glorious resurrection on July 29, 1873, falling from the rocks at Kettleness. This tomb was erected by his sorrowing mother to her dearly beloved son. He was the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. Really, Mr. Swales, I don't see anything very funny in that. She spoke her comment very gravely and somewhat severely.
You don't see aught funny? Ha ha! But that's because you don't go on. The sorrowing mother was a hellcat that hated him because he was a crooked, a regular lamater he was, and he hated her so that he committed suicide in order that she mightn't get an insurance she put on his life. He blew nigh the top of his head off with an old musket that they had for scaring crows with. Twerk for crows then, for it brought the Cleggs and the Doubs to him. That's the way he fell off the rocks. And as to hopes of a glorious resurrection, I've often heard him say myself that he hoped he'd go to hell, for his mother was so pious that she'd be sure to go to heaven, and he didn't want to addle where she was. Now isn't that staying at any rate? He hammered it with his stick as he spoke. A pack of lies! And won't it make Gabriel keckle when Geordie comes panting up the greys with the tombstone balanced on his hump and asked to be took as evidence?
I did not know what to say, but Lucy turned the conversation as she said, rising up, Oh, why did you tell us of this? It is my favourite seat, and I cannot leave it, and now I find I must go on sitting over the grave of a suicide.
That won't harm you, me pretty, and it may make poor Geordie gladsome to have so trim a lass sitting on his lap. That won't hurt you. Why, I've sat here off and on for nigh 20 years past, and it hasn't done me no harm. Don't you fash about them as lies under you, or that doesn't lie there either. It'll be time for you to be getting skates when you see the tombstones all run away with, and the place as bare as a stubble field. There's the clock, and I must gang. My service to your ladies.
And off he hobbled. Lucy and I sat a while, and it was all so beautiful before us that we took hands as we sat, and she told me all over again about Arthur and their coming marriage. That made me just a little heartsick, for I haven't heard from Jonathan for a whole month. The same day. I came up here alone, for I am very sad. There was no letter for me. I hope there cannot be anything the matter with Jonathan. The clock has just struck 9. I see the lights scattered all over the town, sometimes in rows where the streets are, and sometimes singly. They run right up to the Esk and die away in the curve of the valley. To my left, the view is cut off by a black line of roof of the old house next to the abbey. The sheep and lambs are bleating in the fields away behind me, and there is a clatter of donkeys' hoofs up the paved road below. The band on the pier is playing a harsh waltz in good time, and further along the quay there is a Salvation Army meeting in a back street. Neither of the bands hears the other, but up here I hear and see them both. I wonder where Jonathan is, and if he is thinking of me. I wish he were here.
Dr. Seward's Diary, 5th of June. The case of Renfield grows more interesting the more I get to understand the man. He has certain qualities very largely developed: selfishness, secrecy, and purpose. I wish I could get at what is the object of the latter. He seems to have some settled scheme of his own, but what it is I do not yet know. His redeeming quality is a love of animals, though indeed he has such curious turns in it that I sometimes imagine he is only abnormally cruel. His pets are of odd sorts. Just now his hobby is catching flies. He has at present such a quantity that I've had myself to expostulate. To my astonishment, he did not break out into a fury as I expected, but took the matter in simple seriousness. He thought for a moment and then said, "May I have 3 days? I shall clear them away." Of course, I said that would do. I must watch him. 18th of June. He has turned his mind now to spiders, and has got several very big fellows in a box. He keeps feeding them with his flies, and the number of the latter is becoming sensibly diminished, although he has used half his food in attracting more flies from outside to his room. 1st of July. His spiders are now becoming as great a nuisance as his flies, and today I told him that he must get rid of them. He looked very sad at this, so I said that he must clear out some of them at all events. He cheerfully acquiesced in this, and I gave him the same time as before for reduction. He disgusted me much while with him, for when a horrid blowfly, bloated with some carrion food, buzzed into the room, he caught it, held it exultingly for a few moments between his finger and thumb, and, before I knew what he was going to do, put it in his mouth and ate it. I scolded him for it, but he argued quietly that it was very good and very wholesome, that it was life, strong life, and gave life to him. This gave me an idea, or the rudiment of one. I must watch how he gets rid of his spiders. He has evidently some deep problem in his mind, for he keeps a little notebook in which he is always jotting down something. Whole pages of it are filled with masses of figures, generally single numbers added up in batches, and then the totals added in batches again, as though he were focusing some account, as the auditors put it. 8th of July. There is a method in his madness, and the rudimentary idea in my mind is growing. It will be a whole idea soon, and then, oh, unconscious cerebration. You will have to give the wall to your conscious brother. I kept away from my friend for a few days so that I might notice if there were any change. Things remain as they were, except that he has parted with some of his pets and got a new one. He has managed to get a sparrow and has already partially tamed it. His means of taming is simple, for already the spiders have diminished. Those that do remain, however, are well fed, for he still brings in the flies by tempting them with his food. 19th of July. We are progressing. My friend has now a whole colony of sparrows, and his flies and spiders are almost obliterated. When I came in, he ran to me and said he wanted to ask me a great favour, a very, very great favour, and as he spoke, he fawned on me like a dog. I asked him what it was, and he said, with a sort of rapture in his voice and bearing, "A kitten, a nice little sleek, playful kitten, that I can play with and teach and feed and feed and feed." I was not unprepared for this request, for I had noticed how his pets went on increasing in size and vivacity, but I did not care that his pretty family of tame sparrows should be wiped out in the same manner as the flies and the spiders. So I said I would see about it, and asked him if he would not rather have a cat than a kitten. His eagerness betrayed him as he answered, "Oh yes, I would like a cat. I only ask for a kitten lest you should refuse me a cat. No one would refuse me a kitten, would they?" I shook my head, and said that at present I feared it would not be possible, but that I would see about it. His face fell, and I could see a warning of danger in it, for there was a sudden fierce sidelong look which meant killing. The man is an undeveloped homicidal maniac. I shall test him with his present craving and see how it will work out. Then I shall know more. 10 p.m. I have visited him again and found him sitting in a corner brooding. When I came in, he threw himself on his knees before me and implored me to let him have a cat, that his salvation depended upon it. I was firm, however, and told him that he could not have it, whereupon he went without a word and sat down, gnawing his fingers, in the corner where I had found him. I shall see him in the morning early. 20th of July. Visited Renfield very early, before the attendant went his rounds. Found him up and humming a tune. He was spreading out his sugar, which he had saved, in the